It's an anthropological crisis. It's about seeing human dignity and respecting it. And it's about having hope that even in a challenging situation, we can still choose life. We can journey with someone in their suffering in the final stages of their life. This session I have titled A Tale of Two Paintings, and all will become clear in just a second. But the most important thing I'm going to say to you today, and I really do mean this, is that all glory goes to God for anything good that you receive in this session. All the rubbish, that's my fault. Please, God, you forget it before you've even had morning tea this morning. So, A Tale of Two Paintings. In my lounge at home, in our family home, we have two paintings by the same painter, actually, that are hanging on the wall of our lounge. And thank you, Lydia, so much. And I often like to sit there and just gaze at these two paintings and contemplate. Now, they're not the actual paintings. They're worth far too much to be sitting in my lounge. They are printed, you know, reframed reproductions of those paintings. But the first of these paintings by Jean-Francois Millet is called The Gleaners. And it is, some consider this to be his most famous, well-known work, but my wife and I would dispute that. We'll come to that point in a second. But this is a quite a beautiful painting. It shows some woman in France. He actually saw this scene apparently one day traveling through France, and he stopped and he saw a woman who were gleaning. Gleaning is where particularly widows, poor people, the rural poor, what they do is they go through after the main harvest has been collected and they would glean the fields for stalks of wheat and whatever else they could find to take home and cook and make food with, obviously. And so this is a way of sort of contributing to the life of the rural poor. But it's obviously, you can imagine, people who are living in a pretty difficult circumstance who are doing this. This is gleaning. When Jean-Francois Millet painted this, apparently there are allusions to the Old Testament images of the widows. One of the reasons why I like this painting, I think about it, is because one of the scripture passages that has been fundamentally important to me in the work that I do for more than 21 years now is Isaiah chapter 1 verse 17, which is learn to do right, seek justice, encourage the oppressed, defend the cause of the fatherless, and plead the case of the widow. And so I often think about that when I look at this painting, but there's another reason why this painting really resonates with me. And when I often reflect on this, is I actually think about a period in history that wasn't good. And that period in history was when Stalin took over and Soviet communism came to the fore. And something happened in the Ukraine. What they did was they decided to nationalize all of the farms and the grain fields and the wheat growing and everything else. And this, initially what they did was this period, what they first of all did was they demonized the kulaks. The kulaks were the peasant farming class who owned the farms. They're not wealthy, rich elites by any means, but they were the owners of the farms. So first of all, they demonized them and then they dispossessed them of their land. They stole their land and they gave it a nice euphemistic title like nationalizing the farms, right, for the good of the people, the good of the common man. They were kicked off of their farms, and then what happens after this is something known as the Holodomor. Now, the Holodomor in Ukraine is actually just a compounding of two words, holod meaning famine or hunger, and mor meaning plague or extinction. So a genocide of famine. And the death toll was horrific during this period. And in fact, there is a great debate amongst scholars about whether or not this was deliberate or just pure ineptitude. It probably doesn't really matter in the long run, but there is pretty good scholarship that this was also served their deliberate interests in trying to destroy Ukrainian nationalism. This led to a great state of poverty. People were obviously ejected from their land, and the genocide that flowed on from this, it was just horrific. And some of the photos from that period are just truly awful of starving, emaciated children and babies from this period, people just dead on the streets, etc., etc. And one of the reasons why I think about this period when I look at that painting, the painting from Jean-Francois Millet, was because there was a particularly cruel aspect of this particular genocide. They outlawed gleaning. It had been a practice, but it became a capital crime. If you got caught gleaning, didn't matter if you were a young child at night, they'd taken the main harvest for the people. You could come through and pick up the remains of the day, which they were never going to come and collect anyway. You were considered to be guilty of stealing from the people. If you were lucky, you'd get sent to a gulag. A lot of people were just executed for that crime. It's a particularly cruel aspect of this period. And the reason why why this sort of seems important to me is because we are talking about here a regime, a system of control that is driven by ideology, which is where you take an idea first. You don't start with reality. You start with the idea and you try and force the idea upon reality. And you will break reality if you have to try and make it fit your idea. So there's ideology and this control and this ultimately this disregard for human dignity. Absolute disregard for human dignity. With socialism, there is no category of personhood. If you are considered politically expedient or useful, then yeah, they will put up with you and tolerate you and they will allow you to exist and be and do what you want to do. But even then, as soon as you are no longer politically expedient, that's it. There's nothing you can call on and say, hey, what about my human dignity? That doesn't exist as a concept. And what you see in this system is people have become objects. Persons are reduced to objects for the plans, the schemes, the gratifications of others. Persons are no longer respected as persons in their human dignity. They are objects for someone else's plan. They are objects for someone else and their schemes. And often, as we saw in this case, they were very utopian schemes. We are building a better world. Does this sound familiar? It should sound familiar. Steven Pinker, a few years ago, wrote a book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. And effectively, he's trying to make the liberal case for why he thinks we are living in the least violent, most humane period in human history that we've ever lived in. There is a problem here, and I think most of you in the room know what the problem is and the elephant in the room, and he actually addresses it at one point, and he says this: according to an alternate history, the major long-term trend in the West is that people have switched from killing children shortly after they are born to killing them shortly after they are conceived. So we've moved from infanticide to abortion. Now, you notice something straight away. He calls this an alternate history. Where is this weird, kooky idea coming from, right? As if it might not be legitimate. He says this: it is true that in much of the world today, a similar proportion of pregnancies end in abortion as the fraction that in centuries past ended in infanticide. In actual fact, there's far more abortions than there were infanticides in the ancient world. If abortion counts as a form of violence, the West has made no progress in its treatment of children. The moral state of the West hasn't improved. It has collapsed. That's quite an honest assessment of the elephant in the room. But then what does he do with this? Pinker then pretty much immediately goes on to say, this is not the place to discuss the morality of abortion, but the larger context of trends and violence can provide some insight into how people conceive of abortion. So you see what he's done here, this bait and switch? It's moved from there's a problem to I'm not going to address the problem. Instead, it's a pathology. Some people think about this a certain way. I'm just not going to face this reality. We'll just pretend this elephant in the room isn't here. What are we talking about when we talk about this elephant in the room? Well, last year I went and got some data from the World Health Organization, obviously not personally, didn't knock on the door and say I'm here to collect some data, but through their website, and I collated, this is the daily death total, for the top 10 causes of death every single day. And I also added in another two, homicide and suicide, because people often ask me about those as well. They are not in the top 10, for those who are wondering. And when you add those 12 causes of death together, every single day, approximately 95,000 people around the globe die of those top 10 causes plus homicide and suicide. All right, 95,000 people every single day. Just to give you some perspective, in contrast, there are 200,000 abortions every single day around the globe. Every single day, on average. In the last 125 years, all wars, all military conflicts have claimed between 104 to 197 million lives. Now, the exact figure is a little bit hard to land on because, as you can imagine, keeping data, you know, we're a bit more efficient, if you like, and obsessed with data than what we have been in previous decades. So there is some uncertainty about the exact numbers, but let's pretend and presume that the highest number, 197 million, that's the correct one. Let's assume that's correct. So in the last 125 years, all wars have claimed that many lives, 197 million. In the last 3 years alone, abortion has already eclipsed that number in just 3 years, right? Abortion is the number one killer of human beings, and there is nothing close to it. I would argue it is the worst thing that we have done to ourselves deliberately as human beings ever. And here's the thing, it's sold in very utopian terms, generally speaking. It is sold as liberation. It is sold as being about happiness, about control, about, you know, your life, your reproductive freedom, etc., etc. But are women happier? The data we're seeing now doesn't actually seem to indicate that they are happier. In fact, we've got really interesting research coming in, out now, which indicates that particularly women living in the West, there is a great crisis of unhappiness, serious unhappiness to the levels of depression and anxiety. The research indicates to us that married women with children are the happiest demographic. The least happy of all the demographics are unmarried women who don't have children. And that's just one example that we could cite. So the promise, we've been promised this great thing, this great utopia, and the trade-off is we disregard human dignity. Persons, the unborn persons, become objects in our schemes and our plans, right? And we will be happier. We will have a better world. We will be wealthier. You won't be burdened by those financial burdens of extra children. But are we really wealthier? I don't know about you. I'm not feeling it right now in the supermarket, and I don't think we're going to be feeling it at the petrol pump real soon, okay? So we aren't. The reality is, what happened was we ended up, and this is no commentary on women in the workforce, but what we did end up doing was we ended up flooding the workforce with a whole lot of extra labor when women were told, hey, put babies aside, have a career instead, this will make you happy. This is the trade-off. And what happened was that made it a lot more beneficial for employers because now they've got a much larger pool of labor they can draw on, which means your labor prices come down, right? There's a whole lot of trade-offs we've made here. And the question is, are we really happier? Not just that, but we are now heading full steam ahead into a major crisis with birth rates. Our current birth rate in New Zealand is now 1.58. That's slightly higher than what it was last year, which was the lowest it's ever been at 1.54. So slight improvement, but not really meaningful at all. That is a massive decline. And more importantly, it is well below where we need to be at 2.2 births for replacement fertility. We're well below, and we're not the only nation. In fact, most countries around the world are now in this state. Sub-Saharan Africa is bucking the trend a little bit. Maybe we might see in future a MAGA, Make Africa Great Again movement, I don't know. If I was an African leader, I'd be thinking about that now. Let's not export all our brightest and best. Let's keep them here in the most minerally rich per square meter country and make Africa great again. We'll become a powerhouse like we were a couple of thousand years ago. Okay, so we're down at 1.58 births. That's well below replacement level for births. And even more alarmingly here in New Zealand, and this is important, births to New Zealand mothers under the age of 25 have decreased dramatically. So in 1965, it was 46% of all births were to mothers under the age of 25. In 1995, that had decreased almost half to 28%. The latest data, which was just published here in New Zealand only a couple of weeks ago, it is now 14% of all births. Now, those who are in the medical profession in the room, I don't need to tell you why that is a concern. And there's several implications for this. Obviously, if you start having children later, you're going to have less children. And then also there are health considerations that come into play. So this is significant what we are seeing. As I said, this is not just us. This is a Western problem. We are heading into major population decline, what the experts call a demographic winter. And this has huge implications because, for example, how do we pay the healthcare bill for an increasing population over the age of 65? That bill is paid for by having younger members in the workforce who are paying tax to pay for that system. And that's the way it should be. We should care for our older people. But what happens when you have less young people coming into the system to pay for an increasing number of older people? I personally, just between you and me, don't quote me on this, but my personal suspicion is that our healthcare system might be in the best shape it's in for a long time. So I think people think if we get a different government, we can recover it. I'm not convinced we can. I think I'm not sure where the money's going to come from is the point, okay? So there's a big issue here, and this is around the rest of the world. Right now, there has been a huge conversation on environmental issues and global warming and climate change. The experts in demographics tell us that's just not even going to be an issue in about 30, 40 years because there just won't be enough human beings and enough production of things to emit as much carbon anymore. It won't be a conversation. There'll be a very different conversation. My suspicion is that what you'll start to see is wealthy nations who will incentivize people coming from poorer nations. They will get the best and the brightest and the most youthful they can, but they'll offer them free job schemes and houses and all sorts of things to get them into their countries, and a lot of other countries are going to suffer as a result of this particular crisis. And this could be perhaps why we are seeing this becoming more of a resurgent problem for us. And it really is an issue. Because despite all of the talk about dignity and all the conversations about choice, the reality is that euthanasia also is a powerful cost-saving mechanism now in this particular conundrum. There was a report published in Canada not long after they legalized euthanasia, and a group of experts, public experts, said, good news, we've figured out that if people just die 2 weeks prematurely with euthanasia, we can save between 18 and $135 million in our healthcare budget every single year, right? Now, you don't have to make a big deal out of this, but you're a politician, you're just going to say, let's just leave that tap alone. We're not going to turn that tap off, okay? That's the reality of it. The big problem with euthanasia is not the fact of all of the vulnerable people who are coerced into it and all of the awful atrocities we hear about associated with legalized euthanasia. That's a guarantee, and it always happens wherever you legalize it. That's not the problem with euthanasia. The ultimate problem, of course, with euthanasia is that it's a total disregard for human dignity again. A human person says to us as a culture, as a family, as a community, I don't believe my life has any dignity. It doesn't have worth. And we look at that person in their suffering. We look at that person with their disability. We look at that person in their sickness and we say, yeah, you're right. You don't have any dignity. You don't have any worth, and we'll help you end your life. That's the fundamental evil at the heart of euthanasia. The harms that come are also an evil, but they're not the real fundamental moral harm in this. It's the total disregard for human dignity. And then everything else, the changing of medical ethics, you'll hear lots more about this afternoon from Marianne. I just want to highlight one very recent case that you might have heard about from Canada, of all places, okay, in euthanasia. I think the correct pronunciation of this young man's name is Keanu Vafa'ian, I think that's how you say his last name. He was euthanized just weeks ago, actually, just the end of last year in Canada. 26 years old, blind with type 2 diabetes, and experienced seasonal depression. Wasn't terminal, had no major issues, that this was his struggle. And his parents talk about the fact that summer and spring, he was great, life was good, and then he would head into winter, and the winter blues would hit. A lot of us know in this room exactly what that's like. And so they have to work with him. And they thought they'd work with him to bring him out of another period of this. And then suddenly, late last year, he messages them and says that he's going to have an assisted death. He's going to be euthanized. And his parents, the allegation they've made publicly, is that he was actually coached into his euthanasia. That he was told by the doctor who facilitated this how to actually manage his symptoms to meet this new, I think they call it track 2 in Canada, criteria. So he would actually, you know, be able to, and what to say to ensure that he got the euthanasia. You'll never guess who this doctor was who was involved in this case. I can see some of you already smiling. Dr. Helen Wiebe again. This woman, I think, a couple of years ago, had personally euthanized over 400 people in Canada. I think her body count now is much higher than that. That was a couple of years ago. And I'm not particularly surprised by the fact that she is also an abortionist. That doesn't discriminate. Now, if this presentation ended here, you'd go, oh my gosh, Brenton. Oh, I hope that Lydia's got Prozac for us at morning tea. But it is a tale of two paintings, so it's not going to end here. The other painting that we have hanging in our lounge, also by Jean-Francois Millet, and this one is particularly important. Both my wife and I would argue this is his more famous painting. Certainly it was for us. We both had a sort of connection to this painting before we even met, and it now hangs in our lounge on the other side opposite the Gleaners. And it is called The Angelus. And this is a beautiful painting in what it depicts. And what you see here is a typical average farming couple, you might say peasant class, you might say working class couple, stopping to pray the Angelus in the early evening. In the background, you can see a church steeple. The bells would have tolled and everyone would have stopped their work to pray the Angelus. You can see that they are there at the end of the day. There is a basket of potatoes on the ground. Salvador Dali, by the way, was obsessed with this painting. And he wrote a whole book because he was convinced there was a conspiracy theory of sorts. He was convinced that in actual fact, Jean-Francois Millet was actually painting here a graveside death. That was the death of their young child that they were mourning, and then changed the painting. And he said that that basket of potatoes is actually supposed to be a casket for a young child. Now, it's a totally unproven theory, but Dali was obsessed with this. And in fact, some of his work, he actually sort of used this for inspiration. But what's the difference here? In this second painting, we see humility, we see family, we see sacred enchantment. There is the church, there is prayer. We see meaning in suffering and in ordinary, everyday, mundane work. We see self-giving love, we see human dignity. It's very beautiful, it's very simple, but it is all there in that image. And when I look at that image, do you know what I think of? I think of the culture of life that we are all called to live and to build and to proclaim to the world around us. You see, the pro-life movement is not simply about opposing abortion and euthanasia. To be pro-life is not simply to oppose something, to be anti-abortion or anti-euthanasia. No, it is to actually live a counterculture of life. And so what that means for us is that we never have an empty house. There is a passage in the Christian Gospels where Jesus says that if you cast a demon out of a house and leave it empty, what happens? Seven more come along and take up residence. So it's not just enough to cast out and reject the evils of euthanasia and abortion. We've got to fill our house with something else instead so that when the evil comes knocking, there's no space for it anymore. We live a counterculture of goodness, truth and beauty that has profound love and respect for human dignity. It's not enough just to be opposed. It is about living that counterculture, humility, sacred enchantment, meaning in suffering. An essential part of this is community, and it is growing. This need is growing by the day. Vaclav Bender, who was one of the very important figures, dissident Christian figures in Soviet-occupied Czechoslovakia. He was a contemporary of Vaclav Havel. You might know that name. They were friends, actually. And Vaclav Bender wrote a very important essay called The Parallel Polis about when your culture is and has been consumed by the culture of death and ideology, you need to live a counterculture of your own underneath and in the midst of all of that. Vaclav Bender was a married father of five, a Christian man, Catholic husband, five kids. And one of my favorite quotes from him is he said this, "It's bad for your health to meet only at funerals and in front of court buildings." This is a man who lived under the extremes. Czechoslovakian communism was particularly brutal. In other words, it's not good just to meet together when one of your friends has been killed by the regime. Or like in particular, when he said this quote, he's thinking about a Catholic priest who'd been beaten to death and dumped out of a car by government officials. It's not good enough just to meet outside court houses when your friends are being prosecuted or persecuted by the regime and you're meeting to support them and show solidarity. We must live authentic community beyond that. It is bad for your health to meet only at conferences and the March for Life, okay? There should be something more than that, some very important. I've often thought about this. Why aren't we organizing more pro-life meetups? Like actually just gathering together and having barbecues and the likes and just bringing people together of like mind just to have community together. How many medical professionals, for example, who are struggling away often at times against a system that is really putting the heat on them now would benefit from something like that? It doesn't have to be a barbecue, by the way, whatever you want to, right? Not just vigil or a protest, but actually gathering together in community to actually live that counterculture of goodness, truth and beauty together. This is one of the things that I'm really happy to say we've worked hard to foster with Activate. And we're seeing that particularly with the younger people coming through and the solidarity that people find together after that and the way they connect with others and they find a way to navigate forward through this culture in community with other people. Our counterculture is also one of authentic anthropology. Anthropology is what it means to be human. And our authentic anthropology is an important one. It has a sacred, transcendent source of identity. It's not just grounded in this life and our own choices. It looks above and beyond to the divine. This is so fundamentally important. And after now I'm in my 22nd year of working full-time in the space, it has become abundantly clear to me that this Christian vision of reality and the human person in particular is fundamentally essential to our cause. Human persons have a profound dignity and worth because they are made in the image of God. That is a profound reality. And even if you don't believe in God, you definitely want to live in a culture that actually acts that way and believes that truth and acts as if it's real. It's just, to me, it's just inescapable. And one thing that is very clear to me as well is that this is not simply a material crisis. It's about hope and human dignity. And that authentic anthropology actually offers us both. This is not simply about giving people, meeting their material needs. In fact, the data shows us around the Western world, it doesn't really matter what flavor of government you've got, whether it's left or right wing, the abortion rate doesn't change dramatically. So it's not like if we give you more financial support, suddenly the abortion rate magically comes down. It's more than that. It's an anthropological crisis. It's about seeing human dignity and respecting it. And it's about having hope that even in a challenging situation, we can still choose life. We can journey with someone in their suffering in the final stages of their life. My own family is proof of this. I grew up in a family. I'm the eldest of five boys and one girl. My sister wasn't here for this photo we took recently of the Malone boys together. My mother and my father, they conceived two more children, my two youngest brothers. My brother Ben, who's my youngest, and my brother Tim. Tim's in the all-black jersey and Ben's next to him there. And both times the doctors strongly suggested to my mum and my dad that abortion probably wouldn't be a bad idea. It was very insistent, is how my mum describes it. And both times my mother and my father said, no, we don't do that. Why? It wasn't about material goods. It was about hope and a respect for human dignity that actually motivated their life. It was the impetus for why. And I look at this photo, my youngest brother, Ben, he actually lives up here now. He's a music producer. He did his apprenticeship under Neil Finn from Crowded House, and he's a very successful music producer in his own right now. My brother Tim here, he lives in Canada with his wife, and they've got 8 kids, number 9 on the way. And so he's contributed to the world. His retirement is sorted. And he teaches history and classics at a classical education school, an Augustinian academy in north of Toronto. Think about the contribution that would be lost to the world. It wasn't material. It was about hope and human dignity. Right? Our movement, our pro-life movement, is a big tent movement where all people of goodwill are always welcome. You don't have to believe in God to join and be part of this movement. But at the same time, I think our movement will always be a movement built on the Christian vision of reality and the human person. And we should never be ashamed of that. We should never be ashamed of that. So when David Seymour, for example, says in the euthanasia debate, you're just trying to impose your Christian morals on the world when it comes to death and dying. Well, I'm proud of those things. That vision of reality has given us so much, a sense of how we should treat the poor, for example. Who doesn't want that in our culture? A sense of medical ethics that really amplified and humanized medicine in a profound way over the last 2,000 years. I'm proud of that. That's a good thing. Now, just to finish with, remember I told you there's 2 paintings? Tricking. There was actually 3 paintings. There is another painting. And the third and final painting is actually the canvas of your life. All of you is a canvas, or are a canvas. Each one of you is a canvas of sorts where a painting will be painted and others will see and be impacted by the brushstrokes of your life. And I want to finish with 3 little points to give you a sense of hope. Again, I'm trying to dissuade Lydia from handing out the Prozac at morning tea time. And I want to give you an example of 2 of these points. There are 2 beautiful canvases who have painted and are painting something profoundly beautiful for the culture of life. And I know some of you in this room will be familiar with this lady here, Carmel Armstrong. Carmel Armstrong, her canvas is a beautiful canvas. She is now in the twilight. The final brushstrokes are being applied to her canvas as we speak, right? Pretty soon her painting in this earthly life will be complete. But what a painting it has been. Timaru Gill, So I know the Timaru people will be familiar with Carmel. Sister to an ex-Prime Minister of New Zealand. She was a farmer's wife, a nurse, a midwife, a pioneering pro-life leader, former president of Voice for Life, recipient of the Papal Medal in 2015, and then recipient of the Pro Ecclesia et Pontificate Cross in 2025. That's the highest award that the church, the Catholic Church, gives to any layperson for her work. And she really has painted a phenomenal canvas for the culture of life. Almost 50 years of dedicated service to the culture of life. Think about all of the fruit, probably a lot of it we don't even see or appreciate. That's a beautiful canvas. She's not the only one, though. At the other end of the spectrum, and she doesn't know I'm highlighting here today, but it's a beautiful canvas that is just starting to really flourish. This is a photograph of our leadership team from last year's Activate Pro-Life Youth Camp. Stuart's there. Stuart's in the background there. Great bunch. Ellie, who you're going to be hearing from a bit later on. And in this photograph is this awesome young lady here, Genevieve. Her canvas is just starting, and man, those brush strokes are bright and vivid. She's literally just weeks away from starting a tour around the bottom of the South Island, a pro-life speaking tour, speaking to groups about the culture of life. Her own initiative off her own bat. We had her on the leadership team last year. She's coming back again this year, and we've deliberately asked her this year to actually speak and to present this year, and she's going to do that. She's got something very important to say, actually a really beautiful story about the culture of life and other things. This is a canvas that is just starting to flourish. The reason I'm telling you about her is to give you a sense of hope. We often look around and we think, oh, yeah, look at the Carmel Armstrongs, but the movement's fading. No, it's not. It really isn't. The last, and just to prove that point, the final glimmer of hope for you actually doesn't come from a canvas. It's late last year, the head of the Abortion Law Reform Association in New Zealand, so the obviously exact opposite organisation to Voice for Life, the pro-abortion lobby group, the head of the president of the Abortion Law Reform Association in New Zealand late last year, December, gave an interview to the International Socialist Organisation of Aotearoa, their magazine, the communists in New Zealand. And at one point, this is what she said: "The crisis pregnancy centres and the wider anti-abortion movement are really going after youth. This man, Brendan Malone, seems to be the big speaker around this program called Activate. They fund training events for youth. They are well funded." I wish that was true. Everyone thinks that. There's some secret American money coming here. No, it really isn't. I wish it was, but they are well funded. There is very nice food. Yeah, for marketing purposes, let's say that's true. Okay, it's not like a couple of bickies. And it's very emotional. Well, it is when you encounter the truth. There's something profoundly emotional about encountering the truth. It's all lies, obviously not that. They train them how to counter pro-choice narratives. They are targeting very young people, high school age. Yeah, I'm proud to say we are actually. Because I want a future. We are contributing and building that future, and it's a good thing. And the fruit of this is real. It's exciting. It is exciting to see the fruit of this. Tim Wilson from the Maxim Institute said to me, "You know what, Brendan? What you need to do this year with your Activate events is you need to start a hashtag nice bickies." Okay? And I think maybe we will. So on that hopeful note, I'm going to hand back to Lydia. Thank you. Hi there. If you're enjoying our content, then why not consider becoming a paid supporter of our work? You can do that at either Substack or Patreon, and the link for both are in the show notes for this episode. If you do become a supporter, then you'll get access to exclusive content, early release content, and also you'll be helping to fund all of the offline work that we do as well. All of the youth camps and the events that we speak at and all that other stuff that happens that you don't see online. A huge thank you to all of our paid subscribers. It's thanks to you that this episode is made possible.